Paul Krugman is not a fan of President George Bush's economic policies. The twice-weekly columns he writes for the New York Times fairly blister with his low opinion of the president's proposed tax cuts, economic and defense policies. But before anyone tries to impress Mr. Krugman into predictable opposition, they might want to read other columns he's written denouncing those activists who oppose globalization and the World Trade Organization as over the edge. Mr. Krugman, who also still teaches at Princeton University, is the author of a new book in which his columns are collected and expanded. It's called The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. Paul Krugman joins us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
And do you think it's an advantage to you as a columnist that you're not in New York City or Washington, D.C., and you're not, in fact, a professional journalist, although I guess you'd have to be counted as that now, having cashed a paycheck or two that
That's
way.
That's right. I guess, yeah. It's an advantage for me. Being an economist with, I really am an economics professor, I have been in a position to spot things that are just not part of the conventional wisdom and do research on them not by going and talking to government officials, but by talking to experts who really understand the subject and just get ahead of the curve. And I think I've been way ahead of the curve in understanding just what's going wrong in this administration.
Mr. Krugman, what's your problem with the tax cut?
The first thing is simply that it's not affordable unless you're prepared to drastically reduce what our government does. And they've never been clear that that's what they have in mind. So we have a system, we have the institutions from Franklin Roosevelt, from Lyndon Johnson, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, plus we have defense and all of that. And all of that takes a certain amount of money.
Let me interrupt to quote one of your most memorable phrases. You say the U.S. government is best viewed as a big insurance company that also happens to have an army.
That's right. That's where we are. Actually, I stole that from the Peter Fisher, the Undersecretary of Treasury. So it's true, right? You look at what we do and it's at what the federal government does, and it's Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, the insurance programs, plus defense, and then the rest is basically administrative costs. And that takes money. If you want to have those roles, you have to take in enough money to pay for all of it. What it takes currently is something like 20% of the gross domestic product. Thanks in large part to the Bush tax cuts, we're now taking in something like 16% of the gross domestic product. And to keep on pushing tax cut after tax cut without explaining to people that some programs that they depend on will have to be cut to make room for them, that's deeply irresponsible or dishonest or both.
You make a couple of suggestions in this book as to what should be done right now.
Actually, they're not radical or even unusual. So one thing you do, and when the economy has a downturn, state and local governments aren't allowed to run budget deficits. Mm-hmm. So they lay off school teachers and firemen, which is bad because we need those services, and it's also bad because it's a downdraft on the economy. So in a recession, the federal government always provides significant revenue sharing to help out state and local governments through that downturn. This time we didn't. The federal government always tries to move up public work spending that's needed but can also serve to create jobs when you need it. In our case, there's a lot of spending that we need to do for Homeland Security, but we haven't done that.
Mm-hmm. New administration in the state of California has been elected and will be taking over within a few weeks. What advice would you give them?
Finally, I guess Mr. Schwarzenegger is going to have to face up to arithmetic. He was able to evade it all through the campaign. But California has, unlike the federal government, it has to balance the budget year by year. That means you have to either raise taxes or cut spending or some combination of the two. He got through the campaign pretending that somehow or other, by auditing the state, he was going to make the thing go away. That's not going to happen. So he's going to have to make some hard choices. Now, if you ask where did California's budget problem come from, it came from a large increase in education spending, which was not only wanted by the public but mandated by one of those California propositions. And then the dot-com bubble burst and the budget revenues shrank, and so hard choices have to be made. Never has there been a crisis which had less to do with leadership in the sense of charismatic leadership and more to do with just green eyeshades arithmetic.
Is this a good week to remind you to tell us what you said about the energy crisis in California?
Well, sure. Of course, we had that roughly from the fall of 2000 up to June of 2001. There were blackouts, incredibly high prices. The conventional wisdom was Californians brought it on themselves, all those eco-freaks who didn't let them build enough power plants. And I quickly found out, talking to real energy experts, that that wasn't the story at all, that it was really a case of power companies withholding power from the market to drive up prices. The California crisis was an enormous raid on the state of California by energy companies. And, you know, a year after people like myself said that, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission belatedly came to pretty much the same conclusion.
Did you ever worry about getting pegged, about being predictable and therefore dismissible as a columnist?
Yeah, sure. But look, something very important is happening. The easy way out is to just mix and match your columns just to create the illusion of balance and to try to, you know, maintain a kind of ironic distance from it. But this is important. This is my country. I think that these people are undermining the kind of society that I want to live in.
What's more fun for you, the economist or columnist part?
Sorry. It was more fun being an economist. I mean, I wasn't just doing academic stuff. I was kind of an international ambulance chaser, writing about crises in various parts of the world, you know, Indonesia, Argentina. That was my sort of thing. I did a lot. I invented currency crises, not the thing itself, but the academic field about 20 years ago, and business has been good. And it was interesting and somewhat fun because it wasn't my country. The columnist stuff, I mean, I try to have some fun. I like to think there's some humor in the columns. But, you know, in the end, again, it's kind of fraught because this time the bad stuff, the crony capitalism, the budget irresponsibility and so on, is happening in my country. And that makes it a lot harder to keep your distance.
Mr. Krugman, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Columnist Paul Krugman of the New York Times, who's also still a teaching economist at Princeton University, speaking with us from Seattle. His new book is called The Great Unraveling.